evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Chanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Monday, August 14, 2023. Gunmen kill a Sudanese trader in Jonglei State.
One of them was shot and killed. And then they took all the belongings also.
And some South Sudanese activists say the working relationship between the signatories of the 2018 peace agreement is very poor.
The fear here is that if these practices continue, and then the major task ahead of the parliament, like the legislation that are required for the parliament to put in place, we will likely also follow this same suit.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some civil society activists say the controversial approval of the country's budget sends a worrying message to the public. The National Legislative Assembly approved the budget for 2023-2024 fiscal year on Friday amid a walkout protest by the SPLM-IO lawmakers. For VOA Noise, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Peter Malir Biar, chairperson of South Sudan Youth Organization's coalition, says last Friday's controversial approval of South Sudan's budget has exposed serious rift among the signatories of the 2018 peace agreement.
The more this parliament or the party to the peace agreement continue to neck against each other, and especially on issues that concern South Sudanese people, The predictions are that this relationship will deteriorate and eventually the parliament will collapse.
Another activist who heads the nonprofit Action 54 says lawmakers should prioritize the interests of the nation when voting on crucial matters pertaining to the future of the country. Suara Nelson Loboka says a divided parliament signifies trouble for the country.
The fear here is that if these practices continue, and then the major task ahead of the parliament, like the legislation that are required for the parliament to put in place, we will likely also follow this same suit, and which will really temper with the national interests of the country.
Last week, lawmakers from the SPLM-IO, a key signatory to the peace agreement, walked out of the parliament before the budget was approved. Oyen Nathaniel Pierino, first deputy speaker of the National Legislative Assembly, says SPLM-IO protested over a decision by the government to increase civil servants' salaries by 400% instead of a 600% proposal by the SPLM-IO. He says the increment of the civil servant's salary could improve security across the country.
We want to counteract insecurity, which is emanating from the less pay to the members of organized forces and the military. These servicemen are less paid, as I've just alluded to. When they are not paid, they resort to lawlessness, like extorting money from citizens and also erecting roadblocks on the roads in the country.
A member of the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, OSOWA, who did not want to be identified because he is not authorized to speak for the group, says some members of OSOWA walked out, and while others remained in parliament during the passage of the budget. John Agany, the spokesperson of the National Legislative Assembly, says the walkout by SPLM-IO lawmakers did not affect the quorum during the passage of the budget.
We are not going to disturb and also to cheat our nation by passing a budget that will never be executed. So we said that, okay, if the Minister of Finance is saying that he will also pay these 200 after 6 months, let us go for 400, and then the government will be given an ample time to mobilize resources, and then they will pay eventually the 200 additional, then it becomes the 600% increment for all the civil servants, organized forces, and the army.
South Sudan's former Minister of Finance told Reuters in June that 1.8 billion South Sudanese pounds from oil revenues and borrowings will supplement the new budget approved at a sailing of $2.1 billion for 2023-2024 fiscal year. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Jonglei State, where authorities say gunmen killed a Sudanese trader and abducted one woman and her two children in Twitch East County over the weekend. The executive director and acting commissioner of Twitch East County says security personnel are pursuing the suspected perpetrators. For VOA News, Dengai Deng has more from Bor.
Deng Akweikur, the executive director and acting commissioner of Twitch East County, says a group of four Sudanese traders who were traveling in a tractor from Bor to Panyagor were ambushed over the weekend.
One of them was shot and killed. And then they took all the belongings also from the three that people remained, or the three traders that remained. And they also took some of the items from the goods we were on the tractor, and there they went away.
Kur says one woman and her two children were allegedly abducted by the attackers.
People tried to follow, that especially the lady with the two children, but they were not found. They all went.
Abdurrahman Hamid Hamid is the chairperson of the Sudanese community in Jonglei State. Hamid condemned the attack and urged the state government to protect traders who risk their lives to deliver goods and services to people across Jonglei State.
Our message is to the government and especially to the security forces. We urge them to increase and extend their protection to all the people across the state. This year, there have been a lot of deaths and security incidents reported along the roads. We want the government to do more so that there is stability and development.
Jonglei State Minister for Covenant Affairs condemns the attack. John Samuel Manyuan blames authorities in neighboring Greater Pibor administrative area for not arresting criminals who crossed into Jonglei State.
All this happens and the attackers are from Greater Pibor administrative area with substantial evidence, including the woman who went and escaped, testified that these were armed Morley youth from Greater Pibor administrative area. As a government, it's only that we do our part as a government, that our community should not retaliate, our community should not take laws into their own hand. But we find it difficult, especially from the government of Greater Pibor, who keeps silent over this.
Abraham Kelang, the Minister of Information in the Greater Pibor administrative area, says authorities are creating awareness about peaceful coexistence.
2 days ago, we have conference which we done here. We just collecting news from three locations, Lekwangole and Gumruk. We just brought exactly the youth which is staying in Cattle Keeper, which is eight of the youth, for issues coming to just aware issues of peace and way of harmony. But accident happened on Saturday. We didn't hear.
He says the Greater Pibor administrative area has no capacity to disarm civilians and prevent young men from attacking their neighbors in Jonglei State. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
Cameroonians, government and humanitarian agencies are distributing emergency food to millions of people facing hunger along the country's northern borders with Chad and Nigeria. Authorities blame natural disasters, long-running local conflicts, and Russia's war in Ukraine for causing food shortages. For VOA News, Muki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Aid groups and the government of Cameroon say they distributed rice, millet and beans to at least 30,000 people this week along the Central African state's northern border with Chad and Nigeria. Refugee populations and host communities are among the recipients. The government and relief agencies now aim to reach a total of 4 million people over the next 6 weeks. Distribution is complicated by torn-up roads and ongoing clashes between government troops and separatist groups in Cameroon's northwest and southwest regions. Aid agencies have also reported sporadic Boko Haram attacks, but the government has said it will protect all aid workers. Ayisi Numa is the coordinator of the Emergency Food Project at the Cameroon Red Cross, one of the agencies distributing food aid. Numa says undernourishment, famine, movements of people out of their communities in search of food in Cameroon's northern border with Chad and Nigeria are the direct consequences of severe floods and attacks by elephants and migratory birds on plantations. Numa says Boko Haram terrorism and clashes between herders and fishers that displaced more than 100,000 people, including farmers, to Chad, are some of the causes of the present food shortages. Numa spoke on Cameroon State broadcaster CRTV on Friday. The separatist crisis in the west and Boko Haram attacks in the north have disrupted food production and left millions of Cameroonians facing hunger in recent years. Russia's invasion of Ukraine made the situation worse. Before Russia's Black Sea blockade, Cameroon imported 60% of its wheat from Ukraine. The cutoff led to a nearly 50% increase in the price of bread. More recently, floods that swept through towns including the economic hub Douala and Boya and Limbe, both English-speaking Western towns, also rendered several hundred homeless and hungry, the government says. Before Russia's Black Sea blockade, Cameroon imported 60% of its wheat from Ukraine. The cutoff led to a nearly 50% increase in the price of bread. Gabriel Mbairopi is Cameroon's agriculture minister. He says climate shocks added to the present food shortage Cameroon is witnessing.
Agro-pastoral production has been disrupted due to climate hazards, high rainfall in the northern part of the country, sudden cessation of rains in the southern part, which did not allow crops to complete their cycle, crop pests, and destruction of fields by pachyderm and socio-political and inter-community conflicts, affecting 27,000 producers.
Mbarobe says Cameroon's government and its partners are fully engaged to provide emergency food and nutritional supplies to all civilians threatened by hunger and disease. He said, besides distributing food aid, Cameroon is providing hybrid seeds and fertilizers to farmers who agree to return to their farms. The government says it has also distributed drought-tolerant crops to several thousand farmers on Cameroon's northern border with Chad and Nigeria. Meanwhile, Cameroon's livestock ministry reports that several hundred heifers, which quickly adapt to harsh climatic conditions and produce more milk than the local breed of cattle, have been distributed to herders in the area. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, who is your hero? Stay tuned for an answer to that question after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. Question today.
What do you do to conserve your energy when it is very hot outside?
I drink lots of cold water because it relaxes me. So immediately I become dehydrated or I feel hot. I take in more cold water, yes, and it makes me okay.
Well, I live around the beach, so on a hot day I just take a stroll on the shore wearing a light cloth so that I can feel the sea breeze around myself.
If it is hot, you have to make sure that you get somewhere where it is cool. You go and bathe. Those are normal things you have to do.
When I'm at my home, I undress. It is my home. I have a bedroom. My home is big. Why won't I undress?
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
If you are in Sudan witnessing events taking place there, or if you have family you are talking to there, you can call us on WhatsApp and let us know how things are going there. Dial the international code plus one, then 202-258-3076. The number again, the international code plus one, then 202-258-3076.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Zimbabwe celebrates Heroes Day today and Defense Forces Day tomorrow. The idea of a Heroes Day in Zimbabwe continues to be linked to those who fought in the liberation struggle that saw the birth of Zimbabwe. Hosea Zanvashi speaks to young people to see if this is their idea of a hero or it has evolved.
Patience Piri is a creative entrepreneur in Zimbabwe. She says the idea of a hero in Zimbabwe is evolving.
Where we've come from as a people and where we are going, there are changes. Before, we used to think heroes were just people that went to war and fought it out with guns.
Tapiwa Nashe Chiriga is an advocacy officer with a local peace-building non-profit organization called Heal Zimbabwe.
This year, we at Heal Zimbabwe Trust are celebrating the unheralded heroes and heroines who've taken it upon themselves in very difficult circumstances in communities, building tolerance, peace, and social cohesion. They have taken small, yet brave and great strides towards a peaceful and tolerant Zimbabwe, which is also inclusive.
Piri explains her outlook on modern-day heroes in Zimbabwe.
The difference for me is that heroes are community champions, are people that are doing things that will make us better, people that are doing things on the ground, not just talking about it. And these are young people. These are artists. These are nurses. These are teachers. These are farmers. This is everyone, anyone who's contributing. To me, that person is a hero.
Both Piri and Chiriga agree that the definition of a hero or heroine in Zimbabwe is evolving to keep up with the current situation here. Piri says, at a community level, there should be efforts to celebrate everyday heroes while they are still alive, instead of just tributes that are often offered when someone has passed on. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zvinavashe in Harare, Zimbabwe.
From Zimbabwe, we move to Niger, where the military junta says they may put former Nigerian President Mohamed Bazoum on trial for high treason. The statement comes days after the West African Regional Bloc, ECOWAS, issued a deadline for the coup leaders to reinstate Bazoum. Author J. Peter Pham, a former U.S. Special Envoy for the Sahel and a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council, tells VOA's Carol Van Damme that all sides need to de-escalate their rhetoric and ECOWAS should figure out what it can and it cannot do.
It's not helpful that the rhetoric has escalated. You know, a cardinal rule of diplomacy is you never make a threat unless you are prepared to carry it out. Another cardinal rule is deadlines have to be realistic, and they cannot be set up in such a way as to be self-defeating. And unfortunately, ECOWAS has violated both of these key principles of diplomacy. First, the deadline was set way too long, a week, which gave the junta time to entrench itself, deal with, smooth over any dissent within the military ranks, and in fact, win a lot of the population to its side. So they probably shouldn't have set a deadline that far ahead. Then having set the deadline, they should have been more realistic about what they could or could not deliver. And I know there's been the promise at the summit last week that they would raise a standby force, it should have been ready already, but a standby force of 5,000 with no indication of where they were coming from, when they were coming together, and to what end, even if 5,000 were sufficient. And I say this with a bit of experience. When I was special envoy of the U.S. for the Sahel, just before I was appointed, ECOWAS made a grand announcement in the end of 2019. Beginning of 2020, they actually briefed it to the UN Security Council that the regional body was standing up on its own, self-funded, a $1 billion anti-terrorism joint force that by 2024 was going to eliminate terrorism in the region. This force has yet to materialize, and we are in 2023. So forgive me a bit of skepticism about what kind of force they're going to raise quickly.
You do sound skeptical. What kind of force would you envision? What would make a difference for this kind of force to actually make a concrete difference?
Well, to be quite frank, if you're going to reverse a coup, it has to occur in what my friend, former Deputy Assistant Secretary for West African Affairs, Todd Moss, called the golden hour. There's a narrow window right after a coup when it might be possible to reverse it. That window has long since closed. It's very, very difficult for an outside force to come in a situation like this, unless there's support within the country for that force. Otherwise, you're talking about an actual invasion. And classic military doctrine says that an invader requires three times the force of the defender if there's even a chance of success. Niger has 25,000 troops, some of whom are very, very well trained by the U.S., France, and others in as special forces for counterterrorism operations. That requires, assuming that all 25,000 were not present, let's just say, dealing with just Niamey, that's a fifth of the Nigerian forces were available. That still would require 15,000, which is not a number ECOWAS is talking about. So they haven't presented a realistic plan or how they're going to go about this. And there's always risk in these types of operations, risks that someone could get hurt, especially prisoners like President Bazoum or some of his ministers. That risk is there when experienced forces like the U.S. Navy SEALs, British SAS, French Special Forces do it. And we're not dealing with that level of professionalism here.
You laid out in your piece last week about some things that can be done. What do you see happening from this point forward?
Well, I think going forward, one has to figure a way to de-escalate. The rhetoric on both sides needs to go down, whether it be charging the former president, deposed president with treason or war across the Sahel. That's not helpful. Let's de-escalate and let's look at reality. And the reality is we have to try to somehow prevent the situation. It's in everyone's interest that the situation in the Sahel does not get worse, that extremist groups do not have an opening to roll back some of the gains. Niger has managed to increase security. Violence this year is at the lowest level since 2018. Certain development goals have been achieved. IDPs, internally displaced persons, are beginning to be resettled. We have to preserve some of those gains.
That's author J. Peter Pham, a former special U.S. envoy for the Sahel region and a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Damme in Washington this past hour. And that's all we prepared for you this Monday, August 14, 2023. We now leave you with Kwebna Kwebna with the song Dono Bi.
My way out of your door. Oh, yeah. Into some of my head. No, that's a Sasha Shem. Shemani, Mammy, Mammy, Shemani. So be done, I don't need you. You got in my way out of your door. Oh, yeah. Into some of my head. No, that's a Sasha Shem. Shemanim, mamim, shemukie, nana. Onyame na bazawa po yekina, wanem benu benu. Manju jama na meuluda, mesanyu wabu wabu wabu. Meda
We have been listening to Kwebna Kwebna and the song Donobi. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Bob, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States assumed the presidency of the United Nations Security Council for the month of August and immediately focused discussion on addressing global food insecurity. There are now about 260 million people around the world who are acutely food insecure, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
Food insecurity itself drives conflict. It drives forced migration. It stunts growth, both physical growth and economic growth. It holds countries back. It holds people back. The flip side of the coin is we're also increasingly seeing food being used as a weapon of war, for leverage, for political purposes, in conflict after conflict. We just have 91 countries commit in a joint communique to ending the use of food as a tool of war. That in and of itself is a powerful statement, and we urge others to join.
This is most evident in Ukraine, where Russia, having torn up the Black Sea Grain Initiative that allowed Ukraine to export food, has been intentionally targeting food silos in Ukraine, literally destroying food as well as the means to produce it. Russia's actions have serious repercussions for the food insecure. Russia's actions have serious repercussions for the food insecure worldwide. Over the last year and a half, the United States has provided an additional $14.5 billion in food assistance to countries around the world. We are the largest contributor by far to the World Food Program, 50% of its budget every single year, said Secretary Blinken.
But for all of the emergency assistance that we're providing and others are providing, it's not enough. The United Nations, and particularly the World Food Program, has determined that right now we need to address the food insecurity of well over 100 million people around the world.
Finally, said Secretary Blinken, we also have to take a long-term perspective.
By 2050, it is estimated that the population of this planet could be as many as 10 billion people. Demand for food is likely to increase by 50% over what it is today. And yet yields, what's actually being produced, are going down, not up.
We have to, and we are, addressing this challenge, said Secretary Blinken. Through programs like the Vision for Adapted Crops and Soil and New U.S. Initiative, we can grow more resilient, more nutritious food. This is a powerful new way to really make a difference over the long term in making sure that we have strong agricultural capacity and production around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.